James D. Matheson was born in Salt Lake City, Utah, and completed undergraduate study at Harvard College and his MBA from the UCLA Anderson School of Management. He served in the U.S. House of Representatives for 15 years, representing Utah's 2nd Congressional District from 2001 to 2013, and its 4th District from 2013 to 2015. A member of the Democratic Party, he held the distinction of being the only Democratic congressman from Utah during his tenure. During his service in Congress, he gained a reputation for seeking to represent constituents across the political spectrum, balancing the political positions of his elected party in a largely conservative state. Mr. Matheson was co-chairman of the Blue Dog Coalition, a group of 25 conservative Democrats in the House of Representatives. He was also a member of the New Democrat Coalition. Prior to entering politics, Mr. Matheson worked in the energy field, working for several different companies and studying environmental policy. He later started his own energy consulting firm. In 2015, he joined the law firm of Squire, Patton, and Boggs as a lobbyist. His wife, Amy, is a pediatrician, and the Mathesons have 2 sons, William and Harris. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Congressman Jim Matheson.
Well, thank you for that introduction. It is such a thrill for me to be here today. And I thought, as I started my remarks, people often ask me, why did you get into public service? Why did you run for office? Why do you want to be in Congress? And I tell people that the roots of that come from when I was a child, and we'd be sitting around the family dinner table. And my mom and my dad would often talk about the basic idea that I'm sure you've heard from many sources, that while we're here, we should try to make the world a better place. And it's a value that my parents talked about consistently. And it wasn't limited, of course, to being involved in the political world. There are all kinds of ways you can work to make the world a better place, be involved, whether it be a teaching of young people, church service, working for a volunteer organization. There are lots of ways that you can accomplish that value during your life. But, of course, I also did grow up in a family that was interested in public policy. My father, of course, as you may know, was a governor of Utah for 2 terms. And those conversations around the family dinner table that talked about the value of making the world a better place also talked a lot about public policy and how important it was to be engaged and how important it was to contribute. It's not a unique idea that was in the Matheson household. A lot of people have talked about the notion of what we should do while we're here. Just in the last couple of months, I came across a quote from Mariner Eccles. Mariner Eccles, of course, was a Utahn who was significant in the banking industry and significant in creating and managing and formulating the Federal Reserve. In fact, the U.S. Department of Treasury building in Washington, D.C. is the Mariner Eccles building. And Mariner Eccles said, "The only true satisfaction is to feel that we have contributed in some way, however small, to the well-being of others. We are here to enrich the world. And insofar as we lose sight of that fact, we impoverish ourselves." And I think we do want to make the world a better place, and I think a lot of us right now are concerned about what's going on in our country in terms of our politics. I find it interesting. I think most of us, most all of us, really feel quite proud of our country. We feel a sense of patriotism. And yet, at the same time, the latest polls I saw show that about 13% of people in this country approve of the way Congress is operating these days. And I suspect if I asked anyone here if they were part of that 13%, I'm not sure that any hand would be raised in the room. I'm certainly not part of that 13%. But we are proud of our country, so I'd like to think that at the end of the day we're proud of a constitutional system that we want to see work better. And that's really what I wanted to talk about some today is, what can we do to get our system working better? We're so proud of it, and we're not happy with it, so what do we do about it? So first, maybe we ought to talk about why we think it's not working. And look, I'm at the risk of not describing all the factors out there. There's a lot of different variables out there that may have an impact on what's affected the way our government is performing these days. And I acknowledge I'm only going to talk about some, but I think is the fundamental issue that we're unhappy with in the way our system is working right now is the gridlock that seems to dominate our congressional efforts these days. And the gridlock is really a function of extreme polarization. You know, if you look at our Constitution, if you look at Article 1, you know, the first article is about the legislative branch. And if you read that article, you realize that the way the legislative branch was structured is to encourage compromise. And, of course, extreme ideological viewpoints don't accommodate this type of activity. In fact, we're at a point today in our society where words like compromise or consensus or moderate, those are words that are criticized now by the ideologues in our two political parties. They're criticized by extremes on both the left and the right. Now, I'm not naive. We've always had varying degrees of partisanship in our country and in the way Congress behaves. And we've had gridlock at times in our legislative process as a result. But it's worse now than it's ever been. There's data that you can look at the voting patterns in Congress that validate this. It used to be it was only the worst since Reconstruction, but needless to say, Congress has even surpassed that benchmark, and now it's worst of all time in terms of the partisan dynamic and the voting pattern that exists in our Congress. And with that, you have fewer moderates in Congress right now from both parties. And you've seen a really significant change in the number of moderates just in the last decade in the United States Congress. And I think that has resulted in this greater level of gridlock. And isn't it interesting that as a result, the way Congress is behaving, it almost looks like we're a parliamentary system. You know, in a parliamentary system, you vote the party line. But our Constitution didn't structure a parliamentary system. We don't have parliamentary structured elections. We're supposed to be a republic where we elect representatives from around the country that bring their point of view to the table. You know, there weren't political parties when the Constitution was written. And so we've got to be careful about how this is leading us down a path where we're oversimplifying the policy issues that we all care about. We're reducing complex public policy issues to a two-dimensional point of view. And in terms of the parties trying to get more ideological purity, it's like all Democrats think one way and all Republicans think the other way, and that's the only two ways to look at an issue. I think we all know that life many times is not that simple and that it merits not a two-dimensional approach to how we address these public policy issues, but more of a thoughtful approach where we cast the net out and get the views of every elected official from around the country with their own experiences and their own points of view. You know, it's interesting. There's data that shows that as a country, we're not comfortable with this. Some people say, oh my gosh, Congress is so divided, it's so polarized. That means America is so polarized. Interestingly enough, if you look at the latest polling data from, let's say, the Gallup organization, which has been around for several decades, more people now in America than ever before, in the history of this poll at least, identify themselves as independents. They don't identify with either of these political parties. It's not yet a majority of America. It's in the high 40s, but a plurality of people in America actually don't want to be involved with the Republican or the Democratic Party. And so what that tells you that while Congress is behaving in an extremely polarized way, our country's looking for something different. Fundamentally, I think we want our political system to solve problems and achieve progress. And I would also remind you, for one level of comfort you can derive of this, is the fact that we have this gridlock, it actually tells you that our Constitution is still working. Because the Constitution doesn't accommodate these ideological streams. The Constitution, as I said, in Article 1, really talks about building consensus, working toward common ground. I would hope we could take a step back and understand that we actually have a lot of common ground in this country. I don't like the way our politics is described these days in this two-dimensional, Democrats think this, Republicans think that, and we're so different from each other. But that's the way the media portrays our political issues in this fractious, contentious dynamic. In fact, if you look at America and the common ground we share, we have so much common ground in our experience in this country. If you look at global political spectrum, we're not way out on the left like a Venezuela. We're not way out on the right like a North Korea. America occupies a section of that political spectrum that's more centrist than you would ever realize when you listen to the news reports that talk about American politics these days. And so I would submit that we should take a step back and look at that and think about things through that lens of where our common ground exists. Let me give you a quick example that I had in the United States Congress where that approach helped solve a contentious issue. It had to do with public lands issues, you know, a lot of federal land ownership in Utah. And often when it comes to public lands, those issues tend to be categorized in that simplistic two-dimensional way of either we want to protect everything or we want to develop everything. And that's how we should look at public lands issues. And yet those of us who have lived in this state and those of us who have experienced our public lands know that it's just not that simple. And so I took on a task along with Senator Robert Bennett from Utah to address public lands issues in one county in Utah, Washington County, which was a county in the that was growing at a very rapid rate in the early part of the last decade and had a number of issues they needed to resolve about what we could or should not do on various tracts of public land. And so Senator Bennett and I decided we would cast the net out and see what do people think about public lands issues in Washington County. And it turns out it wasn't just two points of view. We actually had all these people come in and engage with us, and we separated them into what we called 23 different stakeholder groups. 23 different points of view on a public lands issue. And it could have been the county commissioners or the environmental community or the backcountry horsemen or the sportsmen or the people in the agriculture industry. There were 23 of these groups, and for 5 years we had a series of meetings about what to do on public lands in Washington County. And after 5 years of painstaking work, you know what? We came up with a consensus. No one got everything they wanted, but every one of the 23 stakeholder groups agreed with what we were going to do. At that point, we submitted the bill, and the United States House and Senate both passed it, and it was signed into law. It's an object lesson about how you legislate. It's not where you get in front of a television camera on a cable station and start screaming about an issue in an ideological way. The actual art of legislating is hard work and time. But I've often said it's amazing what you can accomplish when you get people sitting around a table and actually talking to each other as opposed to just talking past each other over the airwaves. And that is the way you can legislate and get things done. So if we think that the problem is this issue of gridlock and polarization, and we want to try to fix it, maybe we ought to talk about how have we gotten here? What caused this high level of polarization that we have now? I think there are a lot of factors that have caused it, and I'm not going to be able to go through all of them tonight, and I'm not going to necessarily list them in priority order, but there are a number of factors that I think have contributed to this polarization. One is there's just less participation in our political system, and this is part of a broader trend beyond politics. There's less civic engagement in the United States of America. It sort of started in the 1960s, and that trend has continued over several decades to today. And so if there's less participation, then who's left? The people who do participate in politics are the more passionate, the more ideological. Those are the folks who are engaged in our political system. And they have a real disproportionate impact as a result. I mean, I think there's a fundamental premise that I would suggest is our system of democracy is best served when more people engage instead of less. The more the people engage, the more our political process should reflect who we are as a country. It should reflect all of us. Instead, our political process is being more and more dominated by the few who engage. Let me give you a quick example of the disproportionate impact that a few can have. Let's go back to 2008. It's the last time we had a presidential election where, since we had a retiring president, both political parties had a competitive presidential race. You know, the first place where they compete is in Iowa. And Iowa has a caucus system for selecting delegates who are run to support presidential candidates. So here we have two parties competing. A number of candidates in both parties that were legitimate candidates ran great campaigns, spent untold amounts of money. And on caucus night in Iowa that year in 2008, if you take the Republican and Democratic caucuses together, 10% of the registered voters in Iowa. That's it. It's the more extreme ideological elements of the two parties that show up, and that has a disproportionate impact on who gets nominations for President of the United States. And they've learned a lot, these interest groups. They're better now at taking advantage of having that disproportionate impact. They've learned more so how to manipulate the process to maximize that disproportionate impact. That's what's been happening. You know, it reminds me of I say this in almost every speech I give, my Woody Allen quote. You know, Woody Allen in his movie said, you know, 80% of success in life is showing up. Well, that's who's being successful. It's the people who are showing up. The problem is not enough people are showing up. I think another factor that's contributed to the polarization that we have today is how we communicate information today. The digital world has had such an impact on how we communicate. It's had a big impact on what was the traditional media that existed before. It's really undercut the economic foundation of the traditional media we had. Every newspaper, every television station in the country has had to cut back significantly on resources because there are greater economic pressures now to compete for market share. And I think that the quality and the depth of how our media looks at things has been diminished as a result. And it's been replaced with this very dispersed message. You know, how many cable channels are there? A lot of cable channels. There's millions of websites. There's podcasts and blogs you can read. They're all over the place. It's this very dispersed message. And that dispersed message is often being structured in a way around very narrow points of view, and people tune into what they want to hear. And that's taking away from a broader interpretation of what's going on, and I think it encourages polarization. And what happens is, think about it, all the clutter that's out there every day trying to get side of your head and mine, trying to get our attention. There's so much clutter with all those television stations, all those websites, all the information that's out there. How do you break through clutter? You know, there's a tried and true method that's been around for a long time. You got to simplify it. Keep it simple. Don't have a long, complicated discussion. That's hard to break through. And also be really provocative. Boy, if it's provocative, that gets people's attention. And yet that's not a very good way to have a substantive discussion about important public policy issues, is it? Being simplistic and provocative is not helping us. I think it's encouraging this polarization that we have in our politics today about the way we talk about issues. And that's one of the realities of the communication world we're in. But it gets even more problematic when you think about the fact that the digital world is so much more subject to manipulation. You know, not everything you read on the internet is true. And I say that and people laugh, but I'm telling you, this is a problem. Let me give you an example. One of my best friends, childhood friends, I've known him my whole life. He comes up to me a couple years ago and he says, Jim, I just read where you congressmen, if you serve for one term, you get to collect your salary for the rest of your life. And I'm like, John, that's not true. And he wouldn't believe me because he saw it in an email that was forwarded to him on the internet. And this is a guy I've known my whole life. Now, I ultimately convinced him that it was not true, but that's an example of how powerful it can be, this level of misinformation. And let me tell you something. There are folks out there who are deliberately trying to put out misinformation for their own agenda. Happens all the time. And so we've got to be careful because I think that encourages this more polarized dynamic that we have in our country. The irony is this. You know, based on the digital world and the internet, we have access to more information than anyone in the history of mankind, by far. We should be the most informed society ever. And yet, because of that dynamic I mentioned of all the clutter that's out there, to break through, you've got to be sensationalistic or provocative, you've got to be simplistic. I'm not sure that it's resulting in us being the most well-informed society of all time. And I hope it changes, and I hope people look for more information. But that's the circumstance we're in, and I think, as I said, it's definitely contributed to the polarized structure of our politics today. Let me say, this is not limited to politics. This exists throughout our society on the internet. I have a niece who just had some twin babies a few weeks ago, and gosh, she got on the internet and read about some product that she'd bought and from on some blog, and the information indicated this product was, you know, seriously a health risk for her new babies, and it was very emotional, upsetting for her at the time. And it's not true, of course, the information that was on the internet. And my wife's a pediatrician, and she went and talked to my niece about this. But it just shows the power of the internet, particularly when it's emotional. And that was a really emotional thing for her. So as I said, it's not limited to politics. I'm sure we all know that whether it's any of our churches, our religions, even the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints or other religions, there are things put out on the internet that are not always true. So we need to learn to exercise some judgment. We need to recognize that this is what's contributing to more polarized conversation. But let me tell you one more thing about the digital world that we should talk about. There's an article in the New York Times a couple of years ago that mentioned that of the Twitter traffic that exists, and I assume a lot of people listening are involved in Twitter. This article in the New York Times indicated that over 40% of all Twitter traffic wasn't actually made up of people. 40% of Twitter traffic were bots, which is short for robots. These are programmed Twitter accounts, programmed to search Twitter and look for when certain phrases or words are used, to reply, to retweet based on a positive reaction or a negative reaction. And it looks like it's Jim Matheson from Salt Lake City, Utah, but it's not me at all. It's just a computer program. 40%. So you see, there are people out there trying to spin you. They're trying to spin the dialogue. We're all getting spun here in the digital world, and I think it's contributed to these extreme ideological discussions that affect our politics today. And I can just tell you, this is something that my wife and I talk a lot about with our kids. We try to think about, how do we teach our kids the value of judgment and taking time to inform opinion and understanding the source where you get it? Not easy. But I think it's something that collectively we all need to be thinking about for a better engagement in politics and beyond. I think that another factor that's contributed to the polarization is the evolving practices of our political parties and the election pressures they feel. I'm here to tell you, I think the parties, man, their singular focus is on winning the election. It's not about a particular agenda. It's not about making our country better. It's about winning the next election and being in the majority, being in power. That's the big motivation. And generally, to do so, they usually just say bad things about the other party. They never really talk about their own agenda and what they're going to do to make the world better. It's really bad-mouthing the other side. And they continue to play an important role in how our political discussions are framed. And, man, those cable channels love it when they get those kind of statements. That's always what gets put out, because that's what's provocative and that's what keeps market share. Another factor that has affected the gridlock and the polarization of our country is the fact that we draw political boundaries for congressional districts and state legislative seats in an overtly partisan way. The term that you've all heard is gerrymandering. And gerrymandering has gotten incredibly sophisticated in this country. And it's at the point now where the United States House of Representatives is made up of representatives from districts across the country that have been drawn with boundaries that guarantee one party is always going to win. We've balkanized America into Republican districts and Democratic districts where there's no competition. And that's not good for us, because I think competition is sort of a fundamental American value. And I think competition is good. In the private sector, competition keeps you responsive to your customers. In the political world, competition keeps you responsive to your constituents. And yet, we've rigged the system. Both parties have. If you control the legislature in your state, you're going to rig it. I've often said neither party has the guts to compete on a level playing field. And so there are 435 congressional districts in America today, and you know, maybe 3 dozen are competitive, maybe 4 dozen. That leaves you almost 400 that aren't. And instead, people who represent those districts, they face no election pressure in the general election, but they're sure nervous about making sure they get the nomination from their primary. And that takes us back to our earlier conversation about who really engages in those early processes, in the caucuses and the primaries. It's the extreme ideological folks. And so it's pushing more polarization in terms of these elected officials, because that's where they face some competition, not in the general election in November. So where's the model to fix that? Of course, it's you take a look at Iowa, which has a computer model to draw the boundaries. The legislature doesn't get to do it. California now has an independent commission. So we've got two states that have taken some actions to pull the partisanship out of how we draw political boundaries. But most other states haven't. But I think that's definitely contributed to it. And if I talk about this message a little too long, it's because, look, I was the target of aggressive efforts to get rid of me by gerrymandering my district on two different occasions in the state of Utah. And it was blatantly political and blatantly partisan. And I'm not picking on one party because, like I said, whichever party's in control is going to do that. But I do think it's contributed to this polarized dynamic. And another issue that has contributed to it, I should mention the last one, is the influence of money in politics. Now, look, we've always had a concern, we always should, of money in politics. And we're never comfortable with it, nor should we be. But we've taken it to a new level with the Citizens United decision, which allowed unlimited amounts of money to come in from individuals into campaigns and what's called super PACs. You've probably heard of these super PACs. First of all, this is a whole new level in terms of the volume of money that you should be concerned about, and the sophistication of how it's used. And it's a bipartisan problem. We got super PAC money on both sides. Let me tell you an example of where super PAC money played a role. Let's go back to 2012 in the Republican nomination fight for president. And usually in presidential campaigns, as you go from primary to primary, certain people fall by the wayside, and the money runs out, and they withdraw from the race, and the last person standing generally gets to be the nominee. And the Republican process was going down that exact path. And Governor Romney was in a great position to secure the nomination. But there was this one billionaire who decided to fund a super PAC for someone else to keep them in the race. And it kept that Republican primary dynamic going for a few more weeks. Now, did that make a difference in the outcome of the general election afterward? I don't know. I don't think it helped Governor Romney to have to run for several 4 weeks to get that nomination. But we need to take a step back and say, are we comfortable with the fact that voters in all these states were making their decisions and there was a coalescing around one candidate and then one person, one billionaire, didn't like that idea and decided, no, I'm going to disrupt this process and keep another candidate afloat, see if I can help them win. That's the reality of Citizens United. You know, when the Citizens United ruling happened, everyone says, oh my gosh, it's going to be the labor unions and corporations are going to dominate the funding of these things. That's not how it's turned out. It turns out it's a group of billionaires. In fact, in this current presidential cycle, there's been a lot of money already coming to super PACs, and the New York Times just reported in the last couple of weeks that more than half of all the super PAC money has come from just 158 families in our country. We're a country of 300 million people, and we got 158 families dominating what's going to happen in our politics. And I think it encourages a very polarized ideological point of view, because candidates don't have to go out and raise money from a broad group of people like voters. Now they just got to find a billionaire or two who will support them. And I don't think that's helpful in terms of creating a more moderate and balanced way to govern. So I've talked about some of the reasons that have caused this. How do we fix it? Easier said than done, but I'll offer a few thoughts. First of all, there's some structural changes we can look at that would fix it, and we've already covered some of them. One is, in terms of gerrymandering, go with the independent commissions. Elected officials shouldn't be drawing boundaries. And by the way, it's not just that state legislators are drawing boundaries for members of Congress. They're drawing their own boundaries. I mean, I'm not a lawyer, but that's an inherent conflict of interest as far as I'm concerned. And every state legislature that does it, whether they're controlled by the Democrats or the Republicans, oh, they'll give you this big speech about how they were so honorable, how they did it, and they played it all just above board. But don't buy into that. We should have independent commissions to create more competitive districts. That will help moderate our politics in this country. Another idea? Let's look at what California did. They decided instead of having a Democratic primary ballot and a Republican primary ballot, they have one ballot. Everybody's on one primary ballot. Top two go on to the general election. I think that's a good idea for the simple fact that there's a group of people out there who classify themselves as independent who are just not going to take a Democratic or Republican ballot in a primary. But they'll take this ballot because everybody's on it. And so just due to that fact, a one-ballot primary creates greater participation, greater engagement, and with those independents vote, I think it creates a more moderating influence on the ideological extreme dynamic that really is at the primary level. Third, let's get rid of caucuses altogether. It's the lowest participation way we nominate people. Primaries generate more. So I think we should go to primaries. And as I said, let's make it the one-ballot primary. That's a structural change. And finally, we can talk about campaign finance reform. We could talk about that for a long time. But we're going to have to ask some serious questions about the role of these super PACs that is marginalizing candidates. I'm of the philosophy that a campaign ought to be a dialogue between the candidates and the voters. And in the broad echo chamber of what's a campaign with super PACs now, the candidates are getting shoved over here on the side of that echo chamber. And the echo chamber is being filled with third-party money that's generally controlled by, as I said, a few dozen families in this country. I don't think that's serving us well. So those are four structural changes I'd mentioned that we could look at and we should pursue that I think will create a more responsive, participatory situation and less polarization in our politics. But let's not kid ourselves. Structural changes only go so far. There's more of a fundamental issue, and it comes back to the first cause of this gridlock that I talked about is the lack of engagement by what I call the radical center of our country. We need more engagement. And by the way, I'm not sitting here telling you this is going to be easy to make happen. But we need more engagement. And right here in the state of Utah, it's an interesting situation. We have the best volunteerism rate in America, but did you know our voting rate in the general election is the worst? We've got to talk about that. Partly it's because I don't think we have competitive general elections, and so there's not a big reason to vote. But we can do better here in our state. But it's not about just voting in the general election. As we discussed, the table gets set during the nominating process. We need everyone to engage back when we're nominating the candidates in the first place. That's where we need more engagement. And how does this start? It really starts at home. It comes back to what I opened my comments with. I got interested in this system. I got interested in our what it means to be a citizen in this country and public service. I got interested in that because my parents talked about it at the family dinner table. They talked about that value. They told me how important it was. I learned it. I've lived it. I believe it. It's going to take that kind of conversation in all our family dinner tables to encourage this notion of what it means to be a true citizen of this country. I think we need to take the message, though, beyond the home. It's not just around the family dinner table. We need to talk to friends and colleagues, and we need to engage them on what really matters. And we need to resist these simplistic, provocative messages that are dominating our discussion of public policy. And you even need to, you know, this you're going to be surprised I tell you this, but if you really want to engage, talk to elected officials. Remember my Woody Allen quote, 80% of success is showing up? You'd be shocked how few people actually try to go and meet with their elected officials, be it a city councilman or a member of Congress. And if you think you've got ideas that you care about and you want to take the time to go meet with them, they'll take the meeting and they'll listen to you. Show up. That's part of being engaged. The ideologues show up all the time. The extreme ideologues on the left and the right, they show up all the time. We need other people to show up. But you know what? Showing up isn't enough either. You know, Woody Allen said it's 80% of success. 80%, you're in college here, that's a B, right? I think we should shoot for an A. And that means we need an active and informed engagement. It starts early in life. You need intellectual curiosity. I think parents set a tone for how you get this intellectual curiosity. I remember my dad, he used to always talk about when he'd do things, he'd say, you know, if you do your homework and you're prepared, then you do well. And that was always how he was. And I was always impressed. You know, as a kid, everyone idolizes their dad, I guess. But I always thought, man, this guy knows everything. And it's not just that he knows everything, but he knows how things work, and he explains how they affect each other. And he just influenced me from such an early age about being informed. And I'll give you another example of someone who taught me about being informed. I had the honor of sitting next to President Gordon B. Hinckley at a dinner in Cedar City, Utah, back in November 2001. It was celebrating the 150th anniversary of the founding of Cedar City. And, you know, I was kind of a little nervous sitting down next to President Hinckley, but I sat down. He turned to me. He says, "Jim, I understand you're on the Transportation Committee. I want to talk to you about airport security." And he starts going through these issues with me. And I'm thinking to myself, I'm on the Transportation Committee. I need him to come and brief me. And I thought, here he has so much on his plate every day. And yet he was so well informed about issues that were in the public policy arena at that time. It's very inspirational to have that interaction with him. And it taught me this notion that we need to be more informed. It's not easy. Being well informed takes effort, but it also takes judgment. Because as I said earlier, there's a lot of information out there that isn't real. That's too simplistic. You got to really dig to find it. It's that cluttered environment that I talked about earlier. So really, the point of my talk is that I wanted to kind of come here to talk about what the challenges we face and issue the challenge to all of us. The challenge is we really do need to embrace the value of making our community a better place, that value that my parents ingrained in me when I was growing up. We're here on a college campus. What better place to have this conversation? This is a time in life when you come to college and you're developing your life. You're being educated. You're learning. You're exploring. You're having intellectual curiosity. You're learning about a community here on this campus. This is the time to really inform yourself about how to make that commitment to good citizenship and civic engagement. And I know this school has made an active effort to encourage civic engagement, and I applaud Brigham Young University for doing that. And as we do this, we need to remember, while we can be cynical about the way Congress performs, let's remember the value that we all really do place as being Americans. I think we really are proud of our country, and we feel a patriotic duty to make our constitutional system of government work. Remember that when others are cynical about our government. Remind them about that patriotism. Remind them that, as a good citizen, you want to make this government work. And remember that we need to have people resist this simplistic, two-dimensional thinking in our political dialogue. In public policy discussions, we need to identify all the points of view and then determine the common ground among stakeholders. And it's not just that you need to do that in your conversations, but you should hold elected officials accountable to behave that way. That's what we want out of people in public office. We talked about some structural changes. Not easy to make happen. We ought to promote that. We ought to promote those structural changes. Any structural change, I think, in our political system that promotes greater participation is something worth looking at and pursuing. I understand there are a lot of details we didn't talk about, and I understand there are trade-offs, but we should look for greater participation. And that's really my goal today. My goal in today's remarks is to spark a discussion, to encourage all of us to think about our shared values of patriotism, community, and making the world a better place while we are here, and how we can engage in a meaningful way to encourage our political system to advance those values and create a situation where we can be proud of the way our government performs. I know we're all looking for something better from our Congress. I hope we can take ownership in an effort to move forward in making it work better. Thank you so much.